You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is the combined Vanity Fair issue for December of 2022 and January of 2023. And this is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of The Knight's Tale by Adam Ciralsky, with illustrations by Mark Smith. Ritosa's 13th summit was in full swing at Dubai's Waldorf Astoria Palm Jumeirah on December 8, 2020, when 3,500 miles away in Germany, Matthias Knab received an unexpected message. It included a link to a website called fakefamilyoffice.com that began, "I need to warn you about a nefarious operator, Anthony Ritosa, who is a pretender in the world of family offices and should not be trusted with your time and essentially your money." What followed was a takedown that questioned and mocked Sir Anthony's title, educational credentials, career milestones, and claims about an olive oil fortune and a family office. Denny Charid, a one-time financial journalist who now runs his own private wealth meetings, also passed info from the link around. Word filtered back to Ritosa, and Charid, like Knab, soon received a cease and desist letter from Ritosa's Slovenian attorney. Charid was amused by the suggestion that he had defamed Ritosa merely by sharing the contents of a public domain URL. "This is so ridiculous, I will not even bring it to my lawyer's attention," he wrote back, adding, "I believe most of the website's claims." In time, Ritosa's lawyers would send a similarly toothless warning to Graham David Bell, a Dubai-based corporate finance advisor whose clients include some very real and very wealthy sheikhs. As a Brit and the son of a man knighted by Queen Elizabeth II for his service in World War II, Bell took special umbrage with Ritosa's regal shtick. Upon receiving an unsolicited invitation from Sir Anthony to come as a VIP guest to his 18th conference in Riyadh, to be held under the high patronage of His Royal Highness Prince Abdullah bin Musad bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, Bell balked. He doubted the royal stamp of approval and reached out to the supposed patron's close associates, only to be told, he said, that the prince had neither agreed to be a sponsor nor allowed his name and likeness to be used. The prince's representatives declined to comment. At that point, Bell advised several Saudis not to attend. Ritosa caught wind, and to hear Bell tell it went full aggro, issuing cease and desist orders through counsel, along with heavy-handed warnings that the Brit can be imprisoned and forced to pay millions under the UAE's defamation laws. "We told them, 'Sue me, I dare you,'" Bell explained. Silence ever since. That's what Ritosa does: threats, bluster, and then beating a sheepish retreat. I spoke with some 20 past attendees of summits in Dubai, Miami, Monaco, and Riyadh, many of whom shared stories of how they or their colleagues were persuaded to attend and pay significant fees based on Ritosa's pledge to offer access to a raft of high net worth investors. Instead, what they tended to find was a smattering of people with money, but little evident interest in deploying it, and a contingent of conference regulars, some of whom came to resemble role players, listening to pitches from hopeful entrepreneurs, but not coughing up the capital Ritosa claims is there for the taking. In the opinion of these conference goers, it is a far cry from what Sir Anthony aggressively promises, that those seeking investment can expect to find many deeply pocketed people ready, willing, and able to stroke a check. An American participant broke it down this way. For a basic pass, it's around $5,000. If you want meetings, it's a minimum of $18,000. I paid that twice, and they put me in front of bullshit people who didn't have money. Said a European businessman who shelled out a pretty penny, there's nothing wrong with charging $200,000 if you're delivering, but we were sitting inside a summit with hardly anybody with money, only people looking for money. It's souk behavior, say Dana Al-Salem, who has been a panelist and moderator at several summits. She has founded tech, media, and entertainment companies and runs in important social circles in Dubai. If the prices weren't so unreasonable and conference organizers weren't taking a cut, then it's a networking event, she said. I speak at a lot of conferences. Never once have I heard of a host saying, any money you make from any investor you meet, you need to give me a cut. Some, like Al-Salem, were willing to speak on the record. Others were embarrassed that as fiduciaries, they had paid 5 to 6 figures and in return received the Potemkin Village version of the festivities that appear in slick videos posted on the Ritosa Family Office website. Still, there are others, like Carrie Adler, who remain bullish about the gatherings. I've met so many quality people from so many walks of life, he explained. It's almost like it's become a family, a get-together for people where they talk about what they're investing in. Adler is the Canadian CEO of a solar energy concern, Sky Power Global, who has spoken at 9 symposia. There's a lot of potential investors there. Now, are they writing checks? I honestly don't know. No one's opened a checkbook and given me a check. I'm not personally aware of any groups that raise large amounts of capital at these events. Next illustration, the great pretender, Anthony Ritosa, host of wealth summits in Dubai, Miami, Monaco, and Riyadh, has been repeatedly arrested by European authorities. The more I probed, the more apparent it became. Anthony Ronnie Ritosa's shiny story is not only a fable, but a very dark one. And as I got to know some of his old friends, others with close knowledge of the Ritosa family, and a whistleblower who came out of the woodwork, I discovered that Ritosa's slippery demise and reincarnation really began 10 years ago, as his personal and professional lives started to spiral, and he began to reinvent himself in an effort to erase his past. First, some background. Ritosa was born in Sydney in 1969 to working-class parents. The family would occasionally visit the Istrian Peninsula in present-day Croatia, where the Ritosas had Italian roots. After attending a Tony private school in Sydney, the Scots College, he graduated from the University of Newcastle, a fact he has edited out of his narrative. There are other discrepancies as well. We don't have any record of this person as an MBA graduate, a senior official at Harvard Business School insisted after I inquired about Ritosa's claim to have an MBA with distinction in finance from Harvard University. The source continued, he did complete an HBS online course in negotiation mastery, but that certainly is not an MBA, and we only offer a general management MBA. We don't have specialized ones like in finance. Finally, I would be remiss not to add what Harvard Medical School said when asked about Sir Manuel's contention that he has been a professor, collaborator, and/or advisor there. We are unable to find any records of this individual being or having ever been on our faculty working as a researcher, instructor, or a student at HMS. Resume padding is the least of it. There is no olive oil fortune. Or as one former Ritosa associate put it, maybe there were olives in his family's garden. Another close colleague explained, he wants to be seen to have that profile of a high net worth family office chairman. I have not seen proof that qualifies him as being a family office. Sources close to the Ritosa family are withering about the man and the myth. Anthony's the kind of guy that always takes a shortcut, said one. If there's a convenient shortcut, which may or may not be legitimate or ethical or the right thing to do, but it's a shortcut, he will take it. Another commented, he is a highly intelligent and manipulative man with great persuasive powers and the ability to gain confidence, a classic trait all con men have. In the September 15, 2002 New York Times announcement of Ritosa's first marriage to the former Jocelyn Ring, there is no mention of olive oil, a family office, or a fortune. Instead, Ritosa, then 33, was described as a broker at Morgan Stanley in New York who develops trading strategies for hedge funds and whose father had retired as a residential property developer in Sydney. As for Ritosa's studies, the Times noted that he graduated from the University of Newcastle in Australia and received an MBA from the University of Technology in Sydney. The origins of Ritosa olive oil are far more recent and pedestrian. The firm was registered in New York in 2010, with Ritosa's second wife, Sandra, listed as a co-founder. Trying to find the company or buy its products online, however, is a maddening and ultimately futile exercise. Search results redirect to the Ritosa family office or to websites touting tasting competitions the company has supposedly won, but which all end up at the same phone number. The shell game, I learned, is all about putting on airs for a man who most certainly is not an heir. And as for the oil itself, on February 9, 2013, Croatian police arrested a 44-year-old Australian for allegedly stealing 24 bottles of olive oil from a warehouse in the town of Poreč. Coverage in local papers at the time did not name the suspect, but Darko Kadum did. It was Anthony Ritosa, the former director of MIH, the enterprise that controlled the warehouse, told me when I visited him and his wife, Luana, at their villa in the hills above Poreč. At the mention of Sir Anthony's six-century-old fortune, the couple laughed. There may be a few olive trees in front of his family home, Kadum posited, but the olive oil is not produced from those olives. A close family source concurred. There is no 600-year-old family fortune. There are no ties to the Venetian Empire. As it turns out, Ritosa, according to the Kadums, had a deal to import MIH's olive oil to the U.S. with Ritosa's own label affixed to the kegs, not an uncommon practice. When we met, he was a very sweet-talking man, and I'm sure many people would wish to have him as a friend, Kadum explained. We had an intense friendship. Darko visited Ritosa in New York, and, along with Luana, got to know Sir Anthony's family when they came to Istria. But, he said, over time, Anthony changed who he was. By 2012, by Kadum's accounting, Ritosa had accrued $40,000 in unpaid invoices, and MIH stopped the shipments. His friends' increasingly bizarre actions, including the caper at the warehouse, were the final straw, Kadum recalled. The police actually caught him somewhere in the city. They took the oil and brought it back to us, and that was it. Thus, the man whose family office narrative is literally rooted in the roots of Istrian olive trees appears to have been more of an olive oil robber than robber baron. It all traces back to the summer of 2012. Ritosa was on holiday in Istria with Sandra and their two young daughters when, intimates tell me, he seemed to become unglued. Sandra did not respond to request for comment. We saw a lot of oscillation in his behavior, recalled Kadum, citing incidents of physical and verbal violence. Sandra reported her husband to Croatian authorities and took her kids to a town where her father and stepmother had a house. But physical separation did not moderate Ritosa's behavior. He was a violent personality, and he's a big guy, 6'2", 6'3", a strong build, said another person who knew him well back then. Multiple sources close to the family alleged that Ritosa was abusing drugs and alcohol. He was also involved with a Slovenian woman named Stasa Bibic, whom these sources say worked at a local nightclub called Saint and Sinner. The club refused to comment. The pair began traveling, and Anthony racked up massive bills on his and Sandra's credit cards. Bibic, according to the sources, became pregnant and would give birth to a child who now features prominently in promos for Ritosa Summits as a sort of living embodiment that Anthony is the consummate family man. As for Anthony's other family, Sandra, whom he married in 2005, and their two girls, they have been conspicuously left out of his online fairy tale. There is a reason for that. Documents reviewed by Vanity Fair, as well as sources familiar with the matter, confirm that even after his family returned to New York, Ritosa continued bombarding Sandra and others with disturbing and sometimes vicious calls, emails, messages, and voicemails. As she had done in Porridge, Sandra sought protection from law enforcement, and on September 12, 2012, Westchester County Family Court Judge Nilda Morales Horowitz directed Ritosa to refrain from assault, stalking, harassment, menacing, reckless endangerment, strangulation, disorderly conduct, criminal mischief, sexual abuse, sexual misconduct, forcible touching, intimidation, threats, or any criminal offense against Sandra Ritosa. In the wake of the order, however, Ritosa continued leaving what court records and sources described as disturbing messages for his wife, her employer, family, and friends, insisting he was coming to take the girls and harm Sandra. Ritosa was summoned to appear 2 weeks later, but he was a no-show and kept up the threats, including this voicemail on his mother-in-law's phone, edited here for clarity and to remove identifiable information. "It's your favorite son-in-law. I love your daughter so much that I can calmly tell you that she stole money from the Croatian government. And as a result of that, I have no other option but to take your granddaughters away from you. Please come and visit your granddaughters while your daughter, I don't want her to go to jail, but she deserves to go to jail." These words are like a bullet in your head, too. Not just your daughter's head. Yep, yep. Then there's a roaring noise in the background. These words, calm words of love, they're like bullets that kill your brain and your daughter's brain. Calm down, calm down. And there's more roaring in the background. On Saturday night, October 13th, Sandra Ritosa entered the Pelham Manor police station to report aggravated harassment and fearing for her personal and children's safety, according to official records. She gave a statement and told officers about Judge Horowitz's order, which had yet to be served because her husband remained abroad. By Monday, Ritosa had sent Sandra a photo of himself and Bibic on a plane with their tongues sticking out, railing about coming for the kids, and dispatched a racist, expletive-laden screed saying he wanted to have his angels back. That same day, from his perch in Porridge, Ritosa placed a call to Zdenka Ragusupicic, a judge whom Sandra's father, Bruno, had married. Vanity Fair, after petitioning courts in Croatia, obtained records of what transpired next. Ritosa, said to be seeking revenge for Bruno and Zdenka's role in helping Sandra and the girls to safety, declared he was coming to kidnap the couple's young son. Zdenka thought it was a credible threat, recalled a knowledgeable source, as did the police. Judge Zubicic declined Vanity Fair's request for comment. Back in New York, Judge Horowitz gave temporary custody of the girls to Sandra and ordered Ritosa to appear at an October 30th hearing. Once again, he failed to show, possibly because he had been jailed a week earlier by Croatian authorities. Once released, while prosecutors were preparing their indictment, he split town. But if he was on the run, he was running toward the flames. Within days, he turned up in the UK, where he menaced other members of his extended family. According to four sources and official files obtained by Vanity Fair, he was arrested in London and held for 13 days in a domestic violence case, necessitating an urgent result. On November 15th, he pleaded guilty to harassment. Sandra filed for divorce, but that did not end the rancor. The impresario of family office wealth, according to a variety of sources, as well as government and corporate records, stopped making payments on his family's mortgage, resulting in a foreclosure. He ran up nearly $500,000 in unpaid child support, and he apparently failed to pay tens of thousands of dollars in credit card bills. As for the American warrant for Ritosa's arrest, the Pelham Manor Police Department confirmed to Vanity Fair that it was first issued 10 years ago for violating the order of protection and remains in place today. His daughters were losing their home. Their mother was drowning in debt. But Ritosa was busy building a new life with a manufactured persona. He began calling himself the chairman of the Ritosa family office and boasting about his 30 years of investment experience. Never mind that he was born in 1969, which would have meant he started work in his early teens. In truth, his professional life had cratered. He had not held senior executive positions at Nomura, Barclays Capital, Morgan Stanley, BNP Paribas, and Bankers Trust, as he claims online. Instead, sources familiar with his work at each institution confirmed that he held junior to mid-level jobs. And at Barclays, he was allegedly terminated for compliance issues that involved improperly disseminating proprietary bank information, sources told me. Barclays declined to elaborate. Records held by the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which oversees U.S. broker-dealers, show Ritosa's Wall Street tenure to have been more peripatetic than distinguished. For 12 years, he worked at eight firms, making it difficult to build a book of business, much less amass a fortune from it. His middling run in Manhattan Finance, along with his last gig at AlphaSource Capital Securities, went out with a whimper after he refused to attend FINRA-mandated compliance training and left the company. While at AlphaSource, he was clearly not living in the lap of luxury, a former coworker recalled when I asked if Ritosa came from money. He was trying to eke out a living. I think he couldn't cover his expenses, and at some point, he accepted defeat and changed strategies. Part of that new strategy was to completely recast his presence on the Internet. At a time when digital fingerprints are harder than ever to erase, Ritosa has done the impossible. His online profile contains nary a blemish. He is instead a family office influencer, impact investor, mentor, philanthropist, author, and highly sought-after speaker. Not to mention a 2021 nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. His internet persona, in fact, is a constellation of pristine bios, astroturfed articles, and laudatory websites that link back to and reinforce one another. This is no accident. Cyber experts I consulted scanned the dark web, deep web, proprietary databases, and myriad open-source intelligence platforms and found evidence of data hydrology, a systematic effort to water down or expunge unfavorable information and replace it with a shimmering new narrative. This was not some run-of-the-mill search engine optimization that people and companies use to boost their profile and bury their foibles. In the view of these experts, this was next-level shit, because as far as the internet is concerned, Anthony Ritosa arrived on planet Earth a decade ago and has been doing extraordinary things ever since. This image overhaul may or may not have been possible, however, without His Highness Mahmoud Salah al-Din Asaf, a man whom Middle Eastern royal watchers refer to as Milkshake, someone who may have exaggerated or even created his honorific. In 2015, Asaf, by his own admission, certified his status with the Heraldry's Institute of Rome, which sells documents online depicting a family history, blazon, crest, coat of arms, and references to nobility for $200 to $300, depending on whether the customer wants a PDF or a version on handmade paper. Prince Asaf, in fact, used to be a U.S. defense contractor, but before long, he started some remarkable businesses that are ultimately associated with the California strip mall. One of them disinfects car interiors. Another washes, waxes, rehabs, and rebuilds the public image of high-profile clients. Zeus and Nova International, registered in Asaf's name, offers to arrange royal titles bestowed by the world's premier noble families, as well as honorary doctorates and professorships, religious recognitions, and memberships at chivalry clubs. The company also provides clients access to the world's renowned events, from the Oscar Award, and this is misspelled here by leaving off the S, Oscar Award ceremonies, to the Royal Imperial Balls across Europe. Zeus and Nova is registered to the same Orange County complex as a Mexican restaurant and a head lice removal service called Lizzie's Lice Pickers. When I went to eyeball the place, however, I discovered that Asaf had moved out last year, though the business is still active online. I ran into Lizzie and showed her pictures of Asaf. She confirmed his identity, saying she remembered him working late hours, dealing with stuff overseas, adding, "I never heard he was a prince." On a Venn diagram of Ritosa World, Asaf has served as royal patron for the Knight Society of Elvinia and AKBS, which is apropos given that Zeus and Nova is selling people honorary titles and degrees. Meanwhile, Asaf's cohort, Frere Garibal, the knighthood's grand chancellor, acts as chairman of AKBS and sits on Sir Anthony's advisory board for the summits. As for Ritosa, he became a sir courtesy of the knights and is a senior advisor to Prince Asaf, who awarded Ritosa the Grand Cross from the Royal Order of Banu Asaf at Monaco's 2021 gathering. Sir Anthony has also received an honorary doctorate from AKBS, where he is supposedly a professor and a member of the advisory board. The school, which ostensibly offers executive MBAs and professional certifications, is registered to an address on Old Gloucester Street in London. I made a point of visiting while in town for the Prestel conference. Upon arriving at the unassuming four-story building, it took a beat to get my bearings. Apple Maps listed 25 businesses, including a tantric massage service at the location. A foreman, however, was kind enough to point me toward the shuttered door of a company that provides virtual office and postal forwarding services. Sure enough, the central address for AKBS appears to be a mail stop. The Ritosa summits, according to a well-wired American intelligence veteran who took a hard look, have the hallmarks of what is known as a stargaze con. As my source explained, apropos of the Ritosa model, potential marks are wooed by the swank settings and glittering names on the invite list. They suspend disbelief and shell out hefty sums to mingle with and pitch an audience of several hundred from 55-plus countries representing more than $4.5 trillion in wealth. As with Ritosa himself, truth in advertising strains credulity. Despite what his websites say, his ultra-elite investors include a hodgepodge of conference junkies, crypto bros, minor euro and golf royals, and yes, some family offices and high net worth individuals. And no, the hordes did not materialize in Monaco. In the 2 days I spent at the Fairmont, if the 2 days I spent at the Fairmont were any indication, there appeared to be around 100 individuals going in and out of the designated summit areas. Canadian CEO Carrie Adler heard it was 300. So what do participants pony up, beyond the cost of travel and accommodations? Documents obtained by Vanity Fair show that Sir Anthony charges people between $18,000 and $200,000 to pitch an audience that his marketing materials tout as regal and rich. Those that splurge on a platinum presence, for example, make their sales pitch on stage and in various other forums. They enjoy a private exclusive dinner with 25-plus high-net-worth top investors. Also included, fireside chats, discussion panels, and interviews with a handful of business press outlets. Smaller packages dangle the prospect of 8 to 15 one-on-ones with like-minded investors and family offices. The payments do not end there. Participants are informed in writing that these packages are tied with a success fee agreement. Insiders maintain that a number of individuals have been asked to sign away 2.5% to 8% of any successful business partnership agreement derived from Sir Anthony Ritosa's Family Office Investment Conference. Some complied, some did not. Still, others worked out a hybrid agreement, giving Ritosa's operation cash, as well as an equity stake in their business. Such arrangements, according to attorneys and wealth managers, are the sort that might raise eyebrows among regulators, since they may constitute broker-dealer activity, which requires a license, in some, if not all, of the countries where Ritosa has held his summits. There are other rules and regulations, too. In Monaco, you cannot sell or promote a company or give financial advice without a license from Monaco's version of the SEC, explained Giuseppe Ambrosio. Ritosa sells pitches. People are paying him thousands of euros to sell securities in front of an audience. One local counselor suggested Sir Anthony may have pushed another boundary. Monaco, at least on paper, takes a dim view of those who publicly profess to have titles and educational degrees that have not been legitimately conferred. A more prevalent complaint is that the conference has evolved into a fraud, one in which Ritosa lures and then profits off of attendees, some of whom say they were misled about the size and constitution of the audience. We had basically zero investors at these events, one longtime Ritosa team member admitted to me before clarifying. Let me rephrase. The difference between the numbers of investors we would announce and reality was significant. Look at his pattern. It's all about the numbers. Saying that you've got 500 people at a conference when you really have just 200. Saying that you have 500 investors when you really have just 5. He is constantly creating what is not there, like his titles and his education. These guys are predators. They're bilking people out of money who are trying to build real businesses, alleged a prominent money manager in the Gulf who has advised clients to steer clear. Ritosa puts on fake family office events where a lot of people turn up who don't have capital to invest but very much want people to think they do, while genuine entrepreneurs and fund managers are being hustled into giving Ritosa and his company fees and so on. The scale of what he's done is staggering, explained Ari Mello, an American entrepreneur who attended 3 summits in Dubai. Ritosa has bullshitted thousands of people. In my case, I lost a lot of money. His estimate, well over $50,000. By April, he began comparing notes with other conference goers, complaining to an acquaintance in a private LinkedIn message that many of the people attending are veterans of the Ritosa circuit, which has proven to be a giant fraud. When Ritosa heard about the exchange, his Dubai lawyer, the one who had tried to intimidate Graham David Bell, threatened Mello with civil and criminal action. Like Bell, Mello was uncowed. Almost every investor I met at Ritosa's events was looking for money, he said, and many of the people I met there were trying to access my network. I've also never spoken to someone who raised a dollar or met an investor who had a dollar to give. Not all participants are naysayers. Far from it. A spokesperson for Unicoin praised the conclaves as professionally organized and well attended, including by VIPs, remarking on the Ritosa team's excellent reputation and his position as a member of the Forbes Business Council. Adler lauded the summits too, telling me they attract a lot of high-quality people. In virtually the same breath, however, he said he understands the criticism. If I paid $100,000 or $200,000 and thought I was going to sit in a room and meet a bunch of willing investors, you know what? I'd be upset if I didn't meet anyone. I ask about his company's return on investment, given all the Ritosa events he and his team have attended. His answer, have we ever received investment from any of them? No. As for his take on the summit's organizer, he's either just a simple guy that has found a way to pull together a lot of people, or is one of the greatest scam artists in the world. The splashiest deal to ever come out of the Ritosa event? That would involve a blockchain company called Chainstarter. Its CEO is a crypto gadfly named Nick Ayton, who told an interviewer, Chainstarter is proud to be a sponsor for our good friend and host Anthony Ritosa. His summits are the best of the best in a perfect setting. During his recent summit, we achieved $360 million of investments. But when I reached out to confirm the quote and the funding, which would account for nearly 13% of the $2.8 billion Ritosa says has been raised at his events, Ayton ghosted, and repeated approaches went unanswered. A former Chainstarter insider told me, jokingly, I would be very surprised if he raised $360. In fact, the source insisted Ayton's company shelled out hundreds of thousands of dollars to showcase the firm at Ritosa's events in Dubai and Monaco. After I raised Ayton's claim with Adler, he told me he confronted Ritosa about it. Anthony told me he took the guy at his word, he said. I returned from Europe in late June and began writing this story in earnest when a call came in from an unknown number. The woman on the other end described herself as a whistleblower and asked if she could email me about Anthony Ritosa. By that point, I had already sifted through thousands of pages of material about the man and his enablers. I figured one more email was not a heavy lift. The next day, the first salvo arrived. In terms of Anthony, she wrote, I wondered how long it would take for his web of lies and fraud to unravel. Later, she added, he's made up so much. Knight, professor, Nobel nominee. What's next? Astronaut? We spoke several times before she felt comfortable enough to share a record of his misdeeds that included court filings and police reports, a paper trail Sir Anthony could not erase. Anthony Ritosa, I would soon find out, is a scofflaw who has been convicted in two countries and is wanted in a third. The whistleblower's tips prompted me in early September to go back to Europe, this time retracing the would-be heir's footprints across the Istrian Peninsula. I stopped outside the Ritosa family's homestead in Porrec, and indeed saw a few olive trees. But the boughs of those four or five specimens on a rocky outcropping by the Adriatic were scarcely the stuff on which fortunes are made. I traveled to Rijeka to visit with an attorney to review Ritosa's brushes with the law. I discovered that in 2017, only weeks before his Miami summit, Croatian police arrested Ritosa near the Slovenian border. After spending 11 days in jail, he was found guilty of threatening to kidnap the son of his ex-wife's father and stepmother. He faced a year in prison, but the court, perhaps unaware of his brushes with the law in the U.S. and the U.K., gave him probation. As for his explanation to his one-time compatriot, Knob, for why he had gone dark back then, according to a source with knowledge of the family dynamics, Ritosa's mother, Maria, never had a stroke, and Ritosa had not visited Australia around that time. I went to see Ritosa's former friend and olive oil supplier, Darko Kadum. "You want to hear the craziest story?" he asked as we sat under a pergola, sipping a Malvasia from his family's winery. The September sun was setting, and he looked at his wife as if seeking permission before letting loose. He stole his dead father's body on its way from Australia to Croatia. Giovanni Ritosa, the family patriarch, passed away in May 2015 and, per his wishes, was supposed to be interred in a plot in Istria. But according to the Kadums, as well as others with knowledge of what the family endured, Ritosa diverted Giovanni's remains to Slovenia, where, I am told, he stored them in a morgue, while his family frantically tried to determine what was happening. After a time, his relatives would later learn, Ritosa quietly laid his father to rest in a cemetery in the town of Piran. "Keeping a body from being buried for months is just off the charts macabre," said a person with close ties to the Ritosas. "And then not inviting any family to a funeral in another country is soul-crushing." According to several sources, Ritosa had been trying to hide his erratic behavior for some time. It was all about control, they said. It was a message to the broader family, a giant F you all. As I looked out over Kadum's 19th century estate, thinking about the mystery of Anthony Ritosa, something the whistleblower said came back to me. "The most extraordinary thing," she explained, "is that so many people close to him have already been alerted to the fraud and chose to ignore it. To my mind, they're willing accomplices." In the run-up to the 2019 Monaco summit, one of six he has held there, she had even sent emails putting some of the monarch's closest advisers on notice. "His Serene Highness Prince Albert II of Monaco is being courted by a con man with a falsified CV and a history of morphing into a different person when he is caught." The communications, which I have reviewed, outlined Ritosa's legal entanglements, threats of violence, financial problems, and serial deception, and included detailed attachments. "When this becomes public, as everything does in time," she warned, "it will be a massive blot on Monaco." My earlier efforts to engage with the palace had been rebuffed, but I reached out again in September, and this time, courtiers acknowledged that back in 2019, they had indeed received the whistleblower's emails. But a top Monaco official confided, "There were no red flags other than this particular email, and it was hard to tell if it was real or an act of vengeance." That was then. On September 20th, prompted by Vanity Fair's request that responsible palace authorities have another look at the allegations first presented 3 years ago, I was sent a surprisingly frank statement from HSH Prince Albert II. "I have recently been alerted to the fact that the organizer of the events named Sir Anthony Ritosa's Global Family Office Investment Summit, which take place in Monaco, may not meet the principality's necessary requirements in terms of transparency, ethics, and professional conduct. Under these circumstances, and as a precautionary measure, it has been decided that my patronage will no longer be granted for all the organizer's future events to be held in Monaco, thus disallowing any direct or indirect support from the Principality of Monaco. It is to be noted that I never personally attended any of these events. The statement was a fitting coda to Ritosa's regal posturing, a real prince kicking a wannabe knight out of his realm. Nevertheless, the show must go on. Sir Anthony hosted his 20th summit in Dubai in October. Inventing Ivana. Ivana Marie Zelnikova Trump, escaped from behind the Iron Curtain to storm New York City and help define its greed is good era, from her heyday presiding over her husband's properties to her decadent post-Donald denouement, selling costume jewelry and cavorting with a series of freaky Italian lovers, it was Ivana, all along, who gilded the Trump name. By Mark Seal. Opening photo, All That Glitters, Ivana Trump in 1986 at Mar-a-Lago, which she restored. Act 1, The Staircase. She is alone in her seven-story East 64th Street townhouse, atop the steep, spiraling stairs that friends and family have warned could kill her. Tomorrow, July 15, 2022, she is scheduled to fly to Saint-Tropez, her first flight since the isolation of COVID. No one knows when she takes her final step, but some will find comfort when her body is reportedly found in pajamas with a coffee cup instead of a champagne flute nearby. They hope she fell in the early morning hours instead of the darkness of night. Now, 73, or so they say, Ivana has more memories behind her than ahead, but her Louis Vuitton suitcases are filled with her famous shoes, and she is ready to dance on the French Riviera once again. Those shoes, Christian Louboutin and Manolo's and Jimmy Choo's, became part of her legend when she was the first wife of Donald J. Trump, whom she, in her Czech-inflected English, famously called the Donald. By the time he became president, they had both remarried a couple of times. But in 2017, Ivana told ABC News, "I'm basically first Trump wife. I'm first lady, okay?" Her stoic, smiling facade reflecting her pride, but hiding her terror. Her true feelings would come pouring out in the New York atelier of her longtime fashion designer, Mark Bauer, to whom she had come for a fitting on January 11, 2017, 9 days before Trump's inauguration. Always with Ivana, it was fun fittings and champagne and parties, says Bauer. But this time, he noticed something as soon as she stepped off the elevator. The Manolo Blahniks looked slightly scuffed, the toes dented a bit, and not nearly as immaculate as they always had been. Ivana ordered a half dozen tight-fitting, body-hugging, jewel-toned dresses. Then they retired to a couch. The designer and his business partner, Paul Margolin, sitting on either side of Ivana. "So how's everything going?" they ask. "Do you need a dress for the inauguration?" She said, "I don't know if I'm going to go," remembers Bauer. Then she started sobbing, uncontrollably, tears pouring down her face. We both cradled her in our arms, saying, "Everything's going to be okay." Her words came out in a torrent. "They hate me. They all hate me," Brower remembers Ivana wailing. "Everywhere I go, they say things and they shout things at me. Outside my house, in Saint-Tropez, Palm Beach, everywhere, they hate me." Through her sobs, she added, "It's not my fault. I am not him. I divorced him a long time ago. I do not deserve this." The designer was taken aback. "I had to fight back tears myself," he says, "because here was this woman I greatly respected and loved, totally broken down." "But wait. Ivana wouldn't want you to see her like this, gone from a size 8 to a 14, according to Bauer, and, as her longtime nanny turned assistant would say at her funeral, adrift in a sinking swamp of parasites with illicit dreams and schemes. Especially not in the pages of Vanity Fair, which so lavishly chronicled her heyday that a blow-up of her May 1992 cover would stand near the casket at her funeral. No, Ivana would want to turn back the clock and let the spotlight shine on her in her 1980s prime, heels high, shoulders padded, blonde hair big, her smile flashing at 100 watts. a superstar straight out of the era's defining primetime soaps, Dallas and Dynasty. To get there, she had made an unfathomable journey across geographic and social divides, escaping communist Czechoslovakia before flying into Canada on the wings of a marriage of convenience and her credentials as a competitive skier. She was 27 when, in 1976, she finally made it to New York as a runway model. It was there, rocking a blood-red mini-dress in the company of seven other models, that she met her prince. "I love a good-looking man," she said on the Oprah Winfrey Show, then added, "but you know, it's really with the look and the brain and the energy and the really potentials. And, you know, Donald always had a great head on his shoulders, and I saw the potential there." She speaks a little lousy, but she's gorgeous and I'm going to marry her, Trump would later be quoted as saying. Their wedding, technically her second, took place on April 7, 1977, at Marble Collegiate in Manhattan. So began the fertile period when Ivana helped her husband design, construct, decorate, and run his landmarks. "I will pay her $1 a year and all the dresses she can buy," Trump famously said, a comment that supposedly devastated his wife, who was rising fast in the ranks of the Trump Organization. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.